From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In Houston today, residents are returning to their homes a week after Hurricane Harvey slammed into Texas and stayed there, dumping feet of rain. The governor of Texas said today it'll take years for the state to recover. The water is receding in some places, but closer to the Louisiana border, people are still in crisis mode. NPR's Debbie Elliott is in West Orange, Texas. She joins us now. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there.
And you just left Beaumont, Texas, after being there all week. What are things like there now?
You know, Beaumont is still pretty cut off from the rest of the world. I barely got out of there by taking a route that went down through Port Arthur, which is also mostly underwater. But Beaumont has a health crisis underway because they have no water. Their water system was flooded. They won't be able to get to repairs until floodwaters recede. So right now, there is a city of nearly 120,000 people without drinking water. And it's been very difficult getting drinking water in because Interstate 10 is closed both ways and all the other major routes in and out of there are just shut down.
And we've seen some pretty dramatic evacuations in Beaumont as well, including a hospital.
Right. So, yes, yesterday they evacuated about 200 patients from Baptist Hospital there using life flight helicopters and ambulances, taking them to other facilities throughout Texas and maybe even in Louisiana. They had everything from, you know, little NICU infants, new mothers, to dialysis patients who just, they had to have water to take care of these people. So that was happening. And then the city decided it wasn't safe to keep people in shelters in the city. So last night, they took all the people who had been staying in the Civic Center and put them on buses bound for San Antonio for sheltering there. So people who were probably rescued from their flooding homes came to this place for shelter, lost water, now displaced again, having to be evacuated out of Beaumont because there's no drinking water.
And people being airlifted out of Beaumont, too. I saw a woman on television this morning who was being sent to Dallas, and she said she'd never been on a plane in her life and had never been to Dallas in her life before.
Now, a lot of that is happening out of Port Arthur, south of Beaumont. The airport there has military planes that are loading people up and flying them to shelters in Dallas. And there is this just very much this sense of uncertainty for people. It's like, well, where are they? You know, this bus or this plane is going to take me somewhere where I probably have nobody. What am I going to do? I spent some time talking to people in the shelter yesterday before they were evacuated, and it was just heartbreaking to see them feeling so helpless and not knowing what the future holds.
What are things like where you are right now in West Orange, Texas?
Well, it was remarkable, the drive from Beaumont here. I drove on an elevated highway that goes between Beaumont and Port Arthur, first of all, and it gave me a little bit of an aerial view of the city of Port Arthur, which is basically underwater still. And then as I came over the Neches River, it was more of the same. Here in West Orange, Texas, I'm up on kind of a highway overpass, and the homes all around me are flooded. There's a cow that's in knee-deep water over in a field. There's storm debris everywhere. I saw a little child's, you know, toy hammer that had floated off somewhere. And this route is one of the only ways to get in and out. I'm on a state highway. You can hear the trucks going by.
Yeah.
This is the way people are getting in and out with supplies. There have been airboats going by. I saw some guys that were coming from some, you know, Everglades airboats that were coming in to try to help, that normally take tourists around on, you know, tours, and they're coming to help rescue people here. There have been trucks with pallets of water on it, but they're having to navigate like 4 feet of water to get from Interstate 10 to the east onto this highway, and then they're going to try to make their way into where the hardest hit people are. It's really difficult maneuvering in this environment.
Do you have a sense, Debbie, of where authorities are most focused at this point with all of the parts of Texas that are in trouble in different ways?
Well, it's just daunting to think about, but I think there are several things going on. So in Houston, you're turning now, I think, a little bit more toward recovery, whereas the further east you get, They're still very much in crisis mode here in Southeast Texas. It's about rescuing people, saving lives, and in the case of Beaumont, getting them out of there because there's no water. Then it will be time to start thinking about transitional housing. And 364,000 people have registered for FEMA assistance. These are people who are in crisis and needing federal assistance to survive. So now FEMA is about getting them resources, whether it's getting them in a hotel or an apartment, helping them with rent, getting them in some sort of transitional housing. That is the biggest challenge at the moment as they move out of crisis. It's how to get all these people taken care of so that they can start mucking out their homes and putting their lives back together.
That's NPR's Debbie Elliott reporting today from West Orange, Texas. Debbie, thank you so much and great reporting all week.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, one legacy of Harvey will be the citizen rescuers. More than 200 veterans from Texas organized and called themselves Grunt Rescue. Then there's the Cajun Navy. They honed their skills during Katrina. They brought their boats and their knowledge to Houston. And now the so-called Texas Navy, locals just putting in kayaks and fishing and pleasure boats. They include Andrew White, who's rescued more than 100 people. He's recorded his trips. Here's one with his friend David Magdol. They were out looking for survivors when they ran into another man doing the same thing on a road that looked like a river.
So we got a family back here.
Is that the Lamb family? Andrew,
Lamb
I can't move. Dude, watch
right
your foot, watch your foot.
They say they're staying?
Yes.
They say they're staying. And as you can hear, it gets confusing. Well, Andrew White joins us now by Skype. Andrew, you are still doing this today. Talk about how your operation has grown.
Well, when you first start, you just jump in and you see what happens. And then as time goes on, you get better and better and your friends come around you. And so my neighbors have all come together and we've built a team. We've got people who watch Twitter, watch the maps, check where the water's coming. Because when you drop your boat, your trailer is sitting there and your car is sitting there. So you need someone to be in that car, making sure you can get away when the time comes. And you're bringing people out of the water. You've got to drop them off, and so you need other people to pick them up and then drive them further into the city. And so you end up with a team of about maybe four or five people all kind of working closely together.
Right, and you and David Magdol were in the boat looking primarily for people most in need. Who were some of the people that you helped?
So we only focused originally on young people, old people, and sick people, which meant that we were passing by a lot of people who wanted to get out.
Yeah.
That's not fun, but it's just something we felt like we had to do.
Well, and explain to people, because you came across a cerebral palsy sufferer who couldn't move.
Yeah, and that was a scary one, because when you take someone out of a house that's surrounded by water, you have to measure and make a gut check and say, is it safer to take them or safer to leave them? And in that case, it was a very close call in the sense of...
She couldn't swim.
Yeah. Right. Looking back on it, I'm very glad we did that, because that area, the water has risen another 5 or 6 feet.
Oh, my gosh. Well, cancer patients, do I understand? The elderly?
Sure. So we had a cancer patient who had had surgery right before the storm, and he, during the storm, was having a major reaction. I mean, he was sick. His eyes were yellow. He mm-hmm. could barely move. He had a feeding tube, and he needed to get to the hospital immediately. We boated from his house to within 2 blocks of the hospital, and it was wild, but we got him there.
Well, talk a little bit about the wild, because this isn't a little river trip. What's this been like to navigate these waters?
Well, my boat is a 16-foot boat with a 20-horsepower motor that's made to hold 2 people, and we're carrying between 4 and 6. Mm. That weighs the boat down. It changes the ability to move the boat low in the water. And then you have cross currents and fast currents and shallow spots and deep spots, and you are running over cars. And you really didn't want to hit a fire hydrant, because there's no give in that. It was a learning experience for sure.
Well, and yet you were in good company. You know, so many people out doing this. I'm sure you were all sharing stories. You know, look out for the garden hose. I mean, you can't capsize.
No, you can't. And we had a few times where we almost capsized, where we took on water from a downstream, almost getting washed out. And very thankful that that the Lord was with us and nothing bad happened. So.
Well, you know, and I'm thinking too, we didn't mention that you are Andrew White, son of... former Democratic Texas Governor Mark White, who your dad just passed August, that he had to be propelling you to.
Yeah, and my mom told me that too.
Yeah.
my dad, public service was something that he brought into my life, and I got to watch him serve the public his whole life. And even after he was, no longer governor, he never stopped being a public servant. I mean, never. And so it's just something that, he's always told me that God comes first, then country, then family. And so this week, it's been about the country.
Yeah. Andrew White, one of the Texas Navy, the citizens out rescuing people during Harvey. Andrew, thank you, and please stay safe.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I want to encourage everybody out there, stay safe, be strong. We're going to get through this.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Thanks.
President Trump plans to return to Texas tomorrow, this time to visit flood victims. He'd been criticized for not doing that, but he tweeted about his trip this morning. He also notably singled out and praised his chief of staff, John Kelly. There had been rumors of discord. And he wrote, there were many big decisions as Congress returned next week. Might the president have a decision of his own on DACA, the deportation deferment for the so-called Dreamers? Sounds like it's time for our Friday Politics Roundtable.
And joining us today, Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you guys.
And Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision, just back from Houston. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, thanks.
And let's start, Enrique, with the potential decision on DACA. This is President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which granted temporary legal status to young people known as Dreamers. What do you think the president's going to do?
I really don't know. The president said earlier this year that this was an issue close to his heart, that he was struggling to find the right balance between what he called enforcing the laws and dealing with this very delicate, sensitive issue. These young Dreamers, Jeremy, are at the forefront of a new civil rights movement. They are brave. They are determined. They are a voice of the undocumented immigrant community that never really spoke before because they were too afraid. But these kids have confronted their representatives. They are, and we've heard this many times before, as American as any other kid, and they are making meaningful contributions to our society.
Well, Enrique,
so it makes no sense to end the program, Robin.
Well, and Enrique, as you know, it would mean 1,400 workers a day that would be jettisoned if this happened. There are over 107,000 of them, these people who were brought to the U.S. as children. But Rick, as you know, Enrique characterized them one way, but President Trump's core supporters hate the fact that he has not ended this program. The deadline is Tuesday. He could completely end it and jettison 107,000, or he could modify it, or he could ask to push it down the road. But his core supporters want him to end it.
The cross pressures are intense, and a lot of them are going on inside President Trump's head. I've been struck by Enrique mentioned him talking about the tremendous heart he wants to show. He has admitted that he finds this to be a tough call. President Trump doesn't do that very often. He's wrestling with this. He's getting a lot of pressure in one direction from some of the hardliners on immigration, including his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, saying you have to do this. We can't defend it in court. That's the deadline next week. Others are saying, look, it's just a matter of the economy, of compassion, of the quote-unquote right policy. A lot of folks in Congress, including Republicans, are saying push this off. I feel like they're going to move towards some kind of a middle ground. It's not going to be nearly enough. It's not going to be a full protection, maybe some kind of a phasing out, and maybe try to push that deadline back a bit. It's a bit self-imposed by the courts because it's under the threat of this lawsuit that actually the Attorney General of Texas, among others, is involved in. And of course, the disruptive effect of Harvey. There are many undocumented immigrants, we presume, who are now evacuated from their homes. The idea that they would find out while out of their home that they lost that status, that's a pretty unimaginable human side to this.
To your point, Rick, about all of the pressures on the president on this issue, we saw House Speaker Paul Ryan saying today on the question of whether President Trump should end DACA, I actually don't think he should do that. I believe that this is something that Congress has to fix. Enrique, do you see Congress taking up this issue?
Definitely. And just quickly, because Rick mentioned Texas, we have to take into account that Texas has been at the forefront of this anti-immigrant movement. First, their lawsuit against DAPA and DACA during the Obama administration.
This is the parents of the Dreamers, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. SB4, which was supposed to take effect today and didn't, thanks to the court. The fact that now they're trying to pressure the president to end DACA. So that's something we should be considering. And also the necessity, the responsibility Congress has to act on this issue. They tried. during the last administration. It didn't get to the Senate. It passed through the House. Now I think there's bipartisan support on both the House and the Senate, and they should vote on it.
Well, Rick, there are even reports today that Republican North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis is drafting a bill called a Conservative Dream Act, which would give permanent residency to the Dreamers. And remember, it's a finite group of people. You had to have come before, I think, 2007. I hope I have that right. But you had to have come within a certain time frame. So it's a finite group. He's calling for permanent residency. What are the political calculations?
Well, there is a political path that involves legislation. You heard a lot of the Republican critics of the president's move when he moved forward with DACA. People who, like Marco Rubio, for instance, said this is the right policy but the wrong way to do it. You should do it through the normal course of business. It actually opens up some possibilities, whether it's the Tillis bill or something else. There's been a lot of talk in Washington about the potential to use this as a piece of a broader piece of immigration reform that would have to include border security and wall funding. I don't know that many Democrats are going to go along with it, but if you roll this up into the broader issue, it becomes part of the bargaining because no one is questioning. Congress could do this. They could codify or repeal DACA and handle the Dreamers in any discrete way that they wanted to. The issue with President Obama, he did it through an executive order. That's why it can get undone as easily as it might be.
Rick, there's a report today that perhaps because of Harvey and the response to Harvey, that some of the questions that we probably would have been talking about this week if it weren't for Harvey, are the answers are being changed, having to do with the you know, potential for a government shutdown coming up and the potential for a default on the debt. How has Harvey changed what is coming up in September in Washington?
It has changed the direction and made everything just a little bit quieter in my estimation. I talked to the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus earlier this week. This is the hardline group of Republican lawmakers. They've made it really tough on President Trump from the right. Even he is saying, let's just not have a government shutdown now. This isn't the time to litigate the border wall. Let's just get a clean funding bill through. Let's get the Harvey funding through.
Will President Trump go along with that?
I unclear. He is the only person who is actively talking about a government shutdown for the wall, though. Make clear, fewer and fewer Republicans in Congress are even advocating that. He is the only one. You know, my colleague John Carl asked the vice president about this, and he's not taking that threat off the table. But I have a hard time believing he's going to make good on that. I feel like things could actually get to a regular order of business with Harvey and government funding in the next couple of weeks.
Well, it's interesting, Enrique, you were just in Houston, and people there, you know, when you talk about these swaps, shutdown for the wall, some people are saying, what about swapping out the money for the wall for Harvey? I mean, what are you hearing? What were you hearing in Houston?
Just the fact that that was being considered, I find it outrageous. And if there's a silver lining to Hurricane Harvey, it is surely the remarkable rescue stories and all the acts of courage and kindness that we have witnessed during the last week. And I think those people feel that, you know, they need their representatives. They need their government officials to support these and to make them feel that they're not alone in this. So any discussions in Washington about playing politics with
that's what some people are saying. Funds. They're saying don't spend money on the wall. Spend it on Harvey.
Exactly. Of course, and they were talking about $1 billion out of the disaster relief fund being taken out just to start the wall. And I think people there, you know, they're not paying attention to what's going on in Washington right now. They're paying attention to surviving, but they would find that, you know, they will feel betrayed by their officials.
I've also seen a suggestion that instead of building a wall on the border with Mexico, maybe they build a seawall to deal with things like this.
That makes sense.
Rick, on Wednesday, President Trump pitched his tax reform plan on a day when TV was wall to wall. Harvey, let's listen to what he said.
So this is our once in a generation opportunity to deliver real tax reform for everyday hardworking Americans. And I am fully committed to working with Congress to get this job done. And I don't want to be disappointed by Congress. Do you understand me?
Now, you can't see it there, but when he said, do you understand me, he was pointing to several Republican members of Congress who were in the front row there at his event. What's going to happen with so-called tax reform?
There's something else you can't see. That's an actual bill. He was criticizing Democrats for blocking his effort. There is no bill. There's no legislation. There's no language on this. This is an enormously complicated task. The administration at first said it would be done by the end of August. We're in September now. Of course, it's not done. They have not really begun the hard work. It hasn't gone through committee. You haven't had a chance for lobbyists and special interests to weigh in. I've always thought there's a glimmer of possibility, if the president is true to his rhetoric, to maybe even get a bipartisan tax package. But that has not been the message that's come out so far out of the White House and on Capitol Hill. Just hard to imagine, with everything else Congress has to do, that they're going to start pretty much from scratch on a tax bill and succeed in the next stretch of time.
Enrique, just want to
just
ask,
to add, oh, go ahead, I'm go sorry, ahead, to add to that, Robin, think about the president's contract with the American voter. During his first 100 days, he said 10 legislative priorities. None of them have been approved so far, and we're 7 months in. So,
yeah. I just want to ask about the climate in the White House, because before Harvey, that was the storm. You know, people were, you know, shoes were dropping. And we saw the president's tweet this morning praising his chief of staff, Kelly. That followed rumors that he was chafing at being reined in by Kelly. The Washington Post article also cites people saying that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's departure is imminent and that President Trump is fuming over his economic advisor Gary Cohen still after comments about Charlottesville. Rick, just, you know, as we get through this week and concentration on Harvey, are we going to be seeing any more big changes coming up?
It feels like we're primed for that. You have two cabinet secretaries in General Mattis, as well as Secretary Tillerson, who are chafing at the president and publicly contradicting him. In addition to Gary Cohn, you have a president who, according to that report in the Washington Post, isn't enjoying the kind of cloistered atmosphere that his new chief of staff has put in. Recall, it was only about a week and a half ago that we saw a president give that very political speech in Phoenix, and it seemed like a totally different tone than his Afghanistan speech the day before. We've seen all these different versions of President Trump. And I've had people tell me, look, the true Trump is the Trump that you saw on Tuesday night in Phoenix. He loves that campaign atmosphere.
Right.
He even enjoys the disarray inside his own White House. So I don't think that we're done with turmoil inside that staff.
That's Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Thanks to both of you.
Yep.
Thank you.
The Labor Department reported today that the economy added 156,000 jobs in August, falling short of expectations. The unemployment rate went up slightly to 4.4%. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger. She's a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her podcast Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And some economists were predicting a number closer to 200,000. Any idea why this one fell short?
Well, you know what? Some economists did go up to 200,000, but others said 140. And if you look at that range, 140 to 200, coming in at 156 seems kind of spot on. I know it's a tiny bit light. We also got revisions to the previous 2 months that dropped down the initially reported amount by about 41,000. Still, I'd like to point out that we are well into this recovery. In fact, today marks the 100th month of the economic recovery. So getting a job print of 156, or hearing that we have 175 or 180,000 on average a month this year, that's still pretty darn good considering how long the recovery's been going on.
You don't see any signs of weakness here, given that we've seen job growth over 200,000 for a while now?
I really don't. I mean, I think that it was strange that we had a couple of 200,000 month here in 2017. You know, most of the economists that I spoke to at the very beginning of the year had really said, look, this is coming into a very deep part of the recovery. We don't think job creation should average more than 200. Most of them were saying 170, 180. That's kind of where we are. I think the big disappointment is not in the job creation number, but it's in this wage growth, where we seem to be really stuck at 2.5% year over year. That to me seems like a more significant problem as an indicator of how confident people are feeling.
Now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said that Hurricane Harvey had no discernible effect on the employment and unemployment data for August because they collected their survey data before the storm. But do you think that we're going to see Harvey reflected in the numbers in the coming months?
Yes, I think there's no doubt about that. I think that there are a lot of people who were told to not show up to work, you know, 3 or 4 days before the storm hit. It is going to take weeks for many of these folks to get back on the job. And the strange thing is, I know this is like a terrible human tragedy, so I want to kind of shift a little bit and put more of an economics hat on, which doesn't really deal with the emotional part of this. But there is a case to be made that whatever we lose in the near term from an economic impact, the negative part of that, we will make up for once the recovery effort begins. That is, as many people get back on the job, but also more people are employed because you need more hands for the rebuilding process. So I am hopeful that anyone who actually wasn't employed in Texas will be able to find a job, simply because we're going to need a lot of people getting to work there.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks.
Thank you.
Researchers at the University of Wisconsin crunched data, and they've concluded that nothing rivals Hurricane Harvey in the U.S. in the historical record in magnitude. And Houston is a city that's had 16 hurricanes in its first century. But one of the draws of Houston is its affordable housing. And in a regulation-skittish region, there are questions about how those houses have been built and where. Parts of the city that used to be prairie that could mitigate flooding have been paved over. And our next guest says he saw this coming. Historian John Barry wrote Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. He's also a New Orleans resident and a former member of a flood control board there. We'll link you to his writing about Katrina. But John, start with your thoughts as you watch Harvey.
Well, it's not fun. Every time an event like this happens, people in Washington talk about having a new policy. Usually nothing happens.
Start with how we address these storms. We call them 100-year storms, 500-year storms. Remind us, because we're hearing people even this week say, wow, that means it only happens once every 500 years. What does it mean?
A 100-year storm is a storm with a 1% chance of likelihood of hitting any single year. So as each year passes, the likelihood of seeing a 100-year event increases. In the average person's lifetime, it is very likely that they will see at least one storm in their area greater than a so-called 100-year storm. And in fact, in Houston, there have been three 500-year events in the last 3 years. It is one of the most Orwellian, dangerous policy phrases in the English language.
Well, that's what you wrote after Katrina. You say there are three problems in how the country addresses these kinds of disasters: the standard itself, geology and sea level rise, and politics. Are you saying jettison that standard? What would that do if we weren't talking about 100-year and 500-year floods?
It's not so much jettison the standard as understand its meaning. Maybe if they change the terminology, people might realize the risk involved. You know, if they knew protection to the 100-year level actually means they have almost a two-thirds chance over a period of a lifetime of seeing at least one storm that's going to devastate them, then they might rethink where they move. You know, that standard was really pushed largely by real estate developers. The Corps of Engineers actually wanted a much higher standard. The rest of the developed world protects densely populated areas to a much higher standard, at least 500-year, and usually 1,000, and in some cases a 10,000-year standard, whereas we're using a 100-year standard. The phrase itself is so misleading, I would just as soon dump the phrase.
Right. And talk about protecting against the seriousness of storms. And so, for instance, the Dutch protect their cities against a 10,000-year storm.
Correct.
So that comes to the second suggestion you're making, which is geology, sea level rise. This idea that we're losing land mass in areas. We don't have permeable land. There's no place for water to go. We know that global warming and the sea level rise and the sea temperature rise is feeding hurricanes and making them much more powerful. When you have warmer water, it's pulled up into these hurricanes. So what would you do there?
Well, first, let me go back for a second to the 100-year standard. Because of that, you get people settling in areas that really should not be lived in. I think developers, you know, fall into the same mindset as somebody who might buy the property. They think, yeah, that's okay. That's FEMA standard. It seems reasonable. But the standard itself was set for insurance purposes only. It was never intended as a safety standard. People do not understand it, and it's become dangerous.
And so, John Barry, would you be one who would be for something we've been hearing about, which is instead of pumping money into rebuilding homes that are being destroyed on the coast, you know, FEMA buying them back at the value of the house and then raising them so that we get back more land?
I absolutely think that buyouts are underutilized. Another issue, which you mentioned a minute ago, permeability. you don't have to put cement that causes runoff down on your sidewalks and streets. There are products you can use that allow water to seep through.
So permeability, you know, maybe buy back homes, create more wetlands, places for, you know, storms to come onto shore.
Some of the policies on creating wetlands don't make any sense either. If you develop in an area that's a wetland, then you have to mitigate that by creating or preserving wetland somewhere else. What often happens is instead of building land on the coast of Louisiana, and that would be very useful, instead they'll go 50 miles inland and flood something and create a wetland there, which satisfies requirement for mitigation, but doesn't do any good whatsoever to preserve coastal Louisiana. The whole flood insurance program needs serious looking at, and it expires September 30th. I think it'll just be, I hate the phrase kicking the can down the road. I think that's the most overused phrase, but I'm going to use it here. I don't think they're going to really seriously address the problem in the next few weeks. I think they'll simply reauthorize it, try to address it in the future.
Well, that brings us to the third point that you make, which is politics. You know, politicians and lawmakers have to have the backbone to do some of the things needed, including the debate in the flood insurance program is, should taxpayers continue to dole out money to people whose homes are on the coast and are constantly destroyed, or should they not? Environmentalists say, you know, there's no incentive for people to move in from the coast if they keep rebuilding. Is that some of the politics you're talking about?
In Louisiana, they tried to reform the flood insurance program a few years ago, and there were people whose homes were worth $80,000 to $100,000 in coastal Louisiana whose rates suddenly and who had never flooded, whose rates suddenly jumped to thousands of dollars a year. Obviously, that would make this area utterly uninhabitable simply because of the flood insurance rates. It is not a simple question. Take New Orleans, for example. New Orleans has been called the inevitable city on the impossible site. The impossible site is obvious. There is risk there. But the inevitable part of it is also obvious because that's a port that services the entire Mississippi Valley, which extends not just straight north to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but to Pittsburgh, to Kansas City, to Omaha, Tulsa. All those areas actually have direct access to the ocean through the Mississippi River in New Orleans. So it's a very serious question and a complex question.
We'll talk about New Orleans for just a second so we can compare. Because as you wrote, again, this is in 2015, 10 years after Katrina, that amazingly to those familiar with the city, it wasn't only thriving, it was attracting talent. New Orleans was at the top nationwide in Forbes in growth in college grads. It was a destination for working-age Americans. It had Entrepreneur Week. It just was thriving because people flocked there. Volunteers who flocked there stayed there. You had questions about whether or not lawmakers and politicians there were going to follow through and do things like funnel more sediment down to build up land mass. But do you see the same possibility for Houston?
I don't. I think there are a lot of differences between the situations. New Orleans has sort of a mythic place in America, and it's kind of a romantic image, I think. Plus, the city itself was threatened with outright destruction. New Orleans is a very poor city. The state's a poor state. None of those things apply to Houston. Its economy is vastly stronger than New Orleans. It's a much bigger city, has many more resources. Texas has more resources than Louisiana. I'm sure there'll be thousands, if not tens of thousands, of volunteers who go down to help individuals rebuild, but it's not the same kind of situation.
Well, what is the number one thing as you watch Houston, the one thing when you say it's what happens afterwards that counts? What's the one thing that you would say would need to happen in Houston from your historical viewpoint?
Well, chiefly really some serious rethinking about zoning and water management. There is this Dutch phrase, which New Orleans has adopted and talked a lot about, but hasn't actually done much about it, and it's called living with water. I think maybe other than New Orleans, Houston may be the single major city in the country that needs to take that most seriously.
Well, because, as you've told us, they should heed the words of T.S. Eliot, that the power of water is often forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages destroyer reminder of what men choose to forget. waiting, watching, waiting. That's the water. John Barry, author of The Rising Tide and an historian who's looked closely at these water events in history. John, thank you so much as always.
Okay, thank you.
Pablo Escobar said, "Sometimes I'm God. If I say a man dies, he dies the same day."
That's a clip from the Netflix historical crime drama Narcos, which tells the story of Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar and the law enforcement officials who hunted him. Season 3 of that series premiered today. Meanwhile, fans of the revival of Twin Peaks are gearing up for the season finale that airs this Sunday on Showtime. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been keeping up with all of it, and he joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And let's start with Narcos. Pablo Escobar has really been at the center of the drama there, but the end of season 2 showed Escobar being shot and killed by police. What can we expect the show now?
Yeah, that does a little something to the star of this show, right? When your leading guy gets killed. So what's interesting is that the story of the drug trade moves on to the Cali cartel, who kind of take over the business and really corporatize it and make it even more part of the infrastructure of Colombian society. And so the third installment of Narcos deals with the DEA's efforts to go after the Cali cartel, which is actually run by four guys. That turn actually solves a lot of problems that people had with the first two seasons of Narcos. Basically, that it was too focused on Pablo Escobar and that when his story got boring, the show got boring. Here we have four different people leading the Cali cartel. It's a much more interesting story. It's a much more culturally specific story. The only caveat that I would have is that there aren't very many female characters, and the female characters don't have a lot of agency. So This is a very male-centered story, and it's gangsters and DEA people. You know, the Cali cartel was almost thought of as sort of the Colombian KGB. They were so adept at controlling the country and keeping tabs on any effort by law enforcement to curtail them, that the effort to kind of break all of that down is a really compelling story for the third season.
Compelling enough to watch the first two seasons if you haven't already in order to get ready for the third season?
I would say you don't necessarily have to watch the first two seasons. Huh. And I might even recommend it for some people. I think it's more entertaining than the first two. And I was a fan of I've always been a fan of this show.
All right. What about the revival of Twin Peaks, which is going to have its season finale on Showtime this Sunday?
Yeah, so this is one of the most bizarre TV experiments of the year. Basically, they gave David Lynch and Mark Frost, the original co-creators of Twin Peaks, 18 episodes to revive the series 25 years later. The characters were all 25 years older. And what was presented was something that was, I say, aggressively eccentric would be my way of talking about it. You had to know a lot about the characters in the original Twin Peaks to even make sense of the beginning of this story. They are throwing characters at you from the old series, and if you don't know who they are, you know, good luck to you. And then there's also a lot of new characters that were introduced. And, you know, I've always, when I talk about this new revival, I always harken back to the fact that David Lynch started as a painter. And so I feel like a lot of times what painters do is they give you an arresting visual image, and then they let the audience figure it out, right?
Right.
And so I think David Lynch does that a lot. He will present sort of arresting and visually enticing and complex sequences and scenes, and it's kind of up to you to figure out, you know, what they mean. And he's not going to give you a lot of help, and he's not even going to do interviews where he explains what he's doing. But that results in a very complicated story that you have to know a lot about Twin Peaks to get. Even then, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's so surreal that by the time you get to the end of 18 episodes, I'm not surprised that the viewership has been low for this revival.
All right. Well, then let's move on to something where the viewership has been really high, and that is Game of Thrones, which wrapped up over the weekend the latest season. We've
That's
got
right.
one more season coming. Now, at the beginning of Game of Thrones this week, Eric, they ran on HBO like a 3.5-minute promotion for every other show that they do. And it made me wonder, what are they going to do, or how big of a challenge is it for HBO to hold on to people after something like Game of Thrones wraps up, especially when it's going to be so long before we see the next season?
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous challenge. We may not see episodes of the final episodes of Game of Thrones until late 2018 or maybe even 2019. They've got a show waiting in the wings, Westworld, right, that has dominated the Emmys in the same way Game of Thrones has. They have a show that will be debuting just next week called The Deuce, done by David Simon, who originally did The Wire. James Franco plays twins. It's about the emergence of porn in New York in the 70s. So that's an ambitious show that they'll be bringing forward. There'll probably be a couple of years where they will be offering us some things, and they'll be experimenting and trying things until they hit on that next series that takes off, if it's not Westworld, which I still have a hard time believing will rise to that level, although it's possible.
Well, now that Game of Thrones is done, for me, I have moved on to Ozark on Netflix, which I know you like and I'm enjoying as well.
Yeah. Ozark's very good.
That's Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Eric, thanks so much as always.
Always a pleasure.
So much good TV right now. Nice. Just finished The Crown. That's also a
great
on
the third season of House of Cards.
You've got to get caught up.
I know.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Robin Young, this is Here and Now.